Please be seated, and good morning, everyone. Before we get started this morning, I would like to, on behalf of the entire court and my colleague Judge Lee, welcome our newest judge, Judge Joshua Kohler, who comes to us just about a month ago, so he's jumping right in with court sittings. He comes to us from the Northern District of Indiana, where he served most recently as a magistrate judge, and prior to that, as a member of the U.S. Attorney's Office, and did a stint in private practice before that, and we are delighted and privileged to have a judge of his character join the court as our most recent addition. So welcome, Judge Kohler.
Thank you very much, Chief Judge.
All right. With that, I will call our first case this morning. It is United States against Ortho Harris. Mr. Hillis. Mr. Hillis, who is not a newcomer to this courtroom.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Harris on this appeal, and he raises a single issue. I'll begin with the standard of review, because there's a dispute about that, and also move on to waiver. This court has recently issued several opinions that address what the appropriate standard of review is when a district court, either in the course of imposing the sentence or immediately before, alights on something that is then the target of the appeal and says that de novo review is the appropriate standard under those circumstances. And so we would rely on those authorities to say that that is the appropriate standard review. We think we can win even under plain air review if that's not correct. But in the interim, a conversation on waiver may be appropriate. And so where the government asserts there is waiver here, we would say it is not a waiver. We have a pro se defendant. The issue of restitution was not discussed. It wasn't accounted for. There was a single reference to $200,000 as an aggravating factor. That's at page 10. And then in the imposition of the sentence, so the $200,000 is briefly mentioned. Well, my client's sole focus as the pro se defendant is to get the 60-month sentence that he thought he bargained for.
Well, let's back up. There was an explanation of the restitution in the PSR. And the attachment to the PSR. And I know you can test the adequacy of that, but let's just set that aside and focus on what that means for purposes of waiver analysis.
Sure.
Because we do have to contend with our decision in the Flores case and the Hernandez case, as those cases spoke to the line between waiver and forfeiture and how this court analyzes that line and brought about something of a clarification of our case law on how the court analyzes that line when it comes to decisions like this. One of those cases had to do with, the Flores case had to do with conditions of supervised release. I don't need to tell you that. That was your case.
Heard that.
And Hernandez had to do with restitution.
That's
so
right.
You do have to contend with those cases and the sort of a restatement of the law of forfeiture and waiver in this circuit that those cases represent.
Entirely fair, Judge. And so I would also throw in as part of the volley, we would have Jenkins and other cases that talk about criminal history or cases where you have an enhancement that was not something that somebody thought should be included. And those cases don't always result in waiver, even though on all fours they would say they're similar in feature to the cases that you just mentioned. But I'll start with Hernandez. So in the Buster Hernandez case, which is not a case that the government relied on, but I am familiar with what Your Honor is discussing, there was, as the court described it, a strategic reason for the person who was represented by counsel to make a choice to try to focus only on the sentence and not dispute what the loss amounts would be for restitution purposes for the victims in those cases.
And that's specifically the point that I want to focus on, because in the Flores case, and Hernandez built on the Flores case, we said that a strategic reason to give up an issue in the district court is a sufficient condition, but not a necessary condition to find waiver.
Right.
And so is that true in this context as well? Is it one of several factors? And if it exists, then that's, if not decisive, near decisive evidence of waiver. or is it a necessary condition? Because that was what was confusing in our case law before Flores.
Yeah, I think it has to be a necessary condition. If you look to the case law that precedes Flores, precedes Hernandez, it's always the case that waiver is supposed to be construed liberally in favor of the defendant. And so if there is simply a miss and there's not a strategic purpose for it, there is no waiver. It is a necessary condition.
Well, it wasn't in Flores, and that's the supervised release context. So why would that principle that a strategic reason, whether conjured by the court or otherwise, is not a necessary condition in the context of analyzing waiver forfeiture in the supervised release context, but it is in this context.
It would be unsatisfactory, I suppose, to hear that it seems to be sometimes a matter of where we wish to go. And so that is unsatisfying as a litigant and perhaps as a court to apply as a principle. But I struggle when I look at Jenkins to say, if you didn't talk about criminal history, why isn't it waived in Jenkins in other cases where there's enhancement? Why wouldn't it be waived in those circumstances? And it sometimes does seem to read according to case law based on subject matter, Judge. So if you wish to throw your arms around lots of cases and try to reconcile them holistically, I think there's a big job to do on these things. So I would say if we look just at this record in this case, because I cannot easily tell you why it is that somebody should have lost in Flores, lost in Hernandez, won in Jenkins, won in some other case. It seems to be a matter of picking where we wish to go. But I will say this, that if we look at the record in this case, and we're trying to discern a strategic purpose, right, something that is genuine and obvious from the record, we'd look and we'd say that the sentence that my client wanted was 60 months, and once the judge gave 120 months, there's no reason to hold back then unless you simply don't know. And the judge told my client,
Mr. Ellis, if I could cut in here for a second, it seems to me in those cases when we're talking about, we're trying to divine what the strategic reason is, we're trying to figure out what the reason was for the silence, right? Mm-hmm. Here, though, it seems to me that on page 6 of the transcript, the court affirmatively asks Mr. Harris, so are you satisfied with the accuracy of that factual information that is set forth in the report? And he goes, yes, sir. To me, that's not silence. That's affirmative agreement. And so, you know, I guess what more is a judge to do then, right? Because the judge, having been a prior district judge, you know, we are asked to resolve disputes with regard to the factual allegation of the PSR, disputes as to the sentencing range, right? And so one of the first things we do is try to figure out what is in dispute and what is not. And so when Mr. Harris says, you know what, Judge, I'm totally satisfied with the accuracy of the factual statements, including in the PSR, there is later on when they go through sentencing options, what the loss amounts are. Why isn't that an affirmative waiver as opposed to waiver by silence?
Sure. I think you have to look at the exact context and what the question was. So was there a dispute about the facts in the PSR? And my client answers no. My client was also told by the judge he doesn't have to say one thing one way or another in the case. But when he elects to answer and he says no, he answered correctly. All the PSR said is the government's going to seek restitution of $195,000. It didn't give a basis, as is required under the law, for restitution determinations. It simply said, here's what the government's going to ask for. There's nothing by a sort of rendition of proof that's contained in there. So we would be, first of all, looking at the question and the answer. And so, no, there's not an objection when the government's going to ask for this amount in restitution. That's just then a presage, right? A forecast about what we need to do next. And now it is established versus the burden of proof. And we don't want to rubber stamp like the 10th Circuit's cautioned against in Ferdman, Judge.
So, Mr. Hillis, I see what you're saying when the PSR first mentions that the government's going to seek restitution. Yep. But in paragraph 110, right, where it sets forth kind of the sentencing options, mm-hmm. it says clearly there, victim name, Abbas Hamdan, amount of loss, $160,701. To me, that's a factual statement. And the judge is trying to figure out, is this going to be in dispute? And if not, then I'll have to have some sort of evidentiary hearing or bring the victim in or have, you know, some additional factual development for the record. Right. But if there's no dispute as to that amount, I just go on, right?
That's nothing more than a subpart of what the government's request is. The government says it's going to ask for $195,000 of the policy limit. That's the bare minimum that's scrutinized by the insurance company.
But this isn't saying that in 110, isn't saying the government's going to ask. It says under the PSR, this is what it is.
I think Judge Fairley read when the government says it's going to ask for 195, the policy limit's 35, the remaining balance they're going to assert on behalf of Mr. Hamdan is the 160. And then we would look as district court judges to say, so we don't rubber stamp things, what is the proof that is offered by the government? Where's the affidavit? Where's the information that allows us to calculate? We picked this apart, I think, more in the opening brief, but there's nothing about the valuation. So if you were to take an iPhone that is now three generations old and it has the bare amount of memory in it compared to another one, you can't ask for full retail value to be awarded. And this I will have to rush to, but for purposes of plain air review, suppose everything is correct, and we're past waiver at least, and we don't know what standard of review we're going to use, or at least perhaps I don't. We then come to the issue of plain air. And while I think it should be a de novo review, we would still have the inability to impose a sentence that exceeds what the law allows. That includes not just statutory sentencing for amount of imprisonment, but also for amounts of restitution. When we get to restitution, this loss amount, as calculated by the judge, would include lost profits. Lost profits are not allowed under the statutory text that's clear as day. And so there would be a plain error problem with respect to the ultimate calculation of the remaining $160,000.
Well, how would that, and I know you're out of time, but the merits issue is important too, because you're arguing the depreciation issue, you're arguing about the proper measure of loss, whether it's actual or whether it's market value or replacement value. There's arguments about what is the metric for evaluating replacement value. These are highly nuanced questions of loss amount of the sort that would be litigated in civil personal injury cases, for example. And how is it obvious or plain within the meaning of the Alano plain error standard, assuming we're in plain error world here, that it's a forfeiture and not a waiver, how is it obvious to a district judge that these issues are lurking under the surface when an objection is not made? That's a necessary prerequisite for plain error review, to say nothing of the substantial rights and the causing disrepute to the proceedings, et cetera, which are the back-end inquiries.
Right. So that's one part of it. We could back it out a little bit further and say, but the law requires a full accounting, a complete accounting. I'd use the word fulsome, but I might get in trouble. So I would say complete accounting is required, and there isn't one here. Look at the chart. We just have a third party who offers insufficient evidence, less so as a qualitative matter than what we have in Ferdman. We could start there and say that that is a violation, and I have argued that in the brief, to say that that's a problem separate from the metrics and the valuation efforts there. But we did ask the court to take judicial notice, and I think that that would allow us to say these valuations are askew. You cannot have a phone that is many years old selling with no proof of the ability to sell the phone. And so the government didn't meet its burden in the first instance. You have a blanket assertion of a loss amount that is untethered to anything other than a third-party spreadsheet on an amount that it was never going to pay because it far exceeded the policy limits.
Right. The evidence was the insurance claim. And right. And your argument is that we would expect any district judge to recognize that that's insufficient.
Right. That's true. But we also expect every district court judge to comply with the other legal requirements, such as the complete accounting, and that wasn't done here either. So I'm saying if you wish to write an opinion and avoid some of these messy things and throw it back to the district court in the first instance, it's something you can entirely do here because we have the procedural problem, the error that we otherwise complain of. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williamson.
Good morning. May it please the court, Brian Williamson on behalf of the United States. Defendant waived his restitution on appeal, his restitution challenge on appeal by failing to dispute it during sentence. And I want to just broaden our lens a little bit here. It wasn't just that he was asked whether he could confirm the accuracy of the PSR. He was on notice since the plea agreement that restitution would be required in this case. The government appended the insurance report with the corresponding amounts that led to the restitution figure in the government's version of offense. That was reinforced in the government's sentencing memo. And then, of course, we had the PSR, which, as you have already hinted at, in paragraph 110 affirmatively set out that the restitution figures would be roughly 165 or 160 and 35,000.
And earlier in the report, the probation officer elaborated on that by referring to the insurance claim to the extent there was any doubt about the factual basis.
Correct, Your Honor. And conducted interviews with both the victim and an insurance company representative.
Okay, so do we have to take account of the fact that this defendant was proceeding pro se as we apply waiver principles and forfeiture principles?
So I think that the context for that is certainly there, Your Honor. As I mentioned before, if it's a question of notice, he was certainly on notice that a restitution figure was going to be involved, was going to be that $195,000 amount. I would point to the fact that defendant may have been pro se, but he was willing and able to challenge his custodial sentence when the time came. When the judge...
Well, that's a different order of magnitude. He wanted a 60-month sentence, the mandatory minimum, and thought he was going to get it by the way he was reading correspondence with his standby counsel, apparently, reading between the lines of the transcript, and was focused on jail time, not restitution.
I wouldn't disagree that it's a different order of magnitude, but he was certainly willing and able to answer in the affirmative when questioned about the PSR. That's clear in black and white. I'm not sure we can get a reasonable reading of that otherwise, that segment when the sentencing judge asked twice, do you agree with the factual accuracy of what's contained in the PSR? And the government's argument would be that any mention of the PSR would necessarily incorporate by reference, given that there have been prior proceedings on this, prior motions filed on this, that restitution would have been included therein. So to the strategic choice question, defendant's guidelines range was below the mandatory minimum, and he chose not to upset the apple cart by challenging any aspect of the PSR, especially prior to when his sentence was handed down. Here, he was accepting responsibility for his actions, which meant he was taking the victim at his word, which meant that he was accepting the factual accuracy of the PSR, including the items claimed lost in the fire, the vetting that the insurance company had done on those items, and the vetting that probation had done on those claims. Moving on a bit, if this court finds the defendant did not waive his restitution...
Before we get to that point, is a strategic reason to give up an issue a necessary condition for waiver in this context?
Your Honor, I would say here it's just sufficient. The strategic reason backing his decision is clearly present in how this was sequenced. So prior to...
I'm talking about as a general legal rule, as we're sorting out how to find the line between waiver and forfeiture.
Your Honor, the government acknowledges that the case law on this is a little bit mixed, but our position would be that it's a sufficient condition.
Is there a distinction between supervised release condition waivers, which was the context of Flores, and waivers of objection to restitution, to guidelines enhancements, to the other sorts of inputs into the sentencing decision?
Your Honor, I would say that a restitution figure and a supervised release condition are actually fairly analogous in the circumstance. We're talking about something above and beyond the custodial sentence. We're talking about something that is presented within the four corners of the PSR. We're talking about the defendant being on notice of such a thing. There are direct parallels in that analogy.
Ms. Williamson, if the court had directly asked Mr. Harris, so under the PSR, the PSR says the loss amount is $160,000. Do you agree with that amount? And Mr. Harris says, yes. And the judge asks, well, do you intend to challenge that amount? And Mr. Harris says, no. Do we care why he's saying those things?
At that stage, Your Honor, that would be clear enough that we wouldn't be trying to read the tea leaves of an intentional relinquishment or not. I think that's a little bit more advanced and forward than the circumstances we're talking about here, but it's not altogether that different because we end up in the same place. But there, that's more in intentional relinquishment with a, you know, no question of whether there's a strategic choice behind that, rather than falling back on whether the government can proffer a strategic choice after the fact.
So the strategic choice analysis is really useful in those instances where there's some ambiguity in the record.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So it's never a necessary condition. It's just a useful data point.
Correct, Your Honor. So moving on to the should plain error apply. Here, the district court merely adopted an undisputed portion of the PSR. Federal courts may only order restitution when authorized by statute, and here the preponderance standard that defendant cites in his briefs is only required upon a resolution of dispute. And as we've just shown, because nothing was disputed, nothing was challenged, that preponderance standard does not come into play. So what we're left with is whether the district court had information sufficient to arrive at a restitution order. This principle aligns with court's obligations as to other parts of the PSR at sentencing. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32I provides that a district court may accept any undisputed portion of the PSR as a finding of fact, and this court has supported that. So certainly it would not be plain error for the court to rely on an undisputed point of the PSR. And even if the district court was required to make a finding, so setting aside that the PSR was undisputed, if the district court was required to make a finding, it did not plainly err in making the victim whole by ordering restitution for the full value of goods lost in the fire. It's important to remember that the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, the purpose behind that is to restore the victim to their original state of well-being. And here, the items lost in the fire accounted for that state of being prior to the crime occurred.
Well, replacement values is going to yield a higher number than market value once depreciation and obsolescence are considered in the context of cell phones and like.
Your Honor, I'd actually argue that replacement cost would be a lower value than retail cost because replacement cost has not yet incorporated overhead, maintenance, labor, storage, those types of calculations that make up a higher retail value after the fact. So the insurance report is quite clear that we're in cost land, we're not in price land, and the insurance company does calculate replacement cost with regards to certain items as it made up the policy cap.
For the $35,000 that constituted policy limits, but the larger share, the lion's share of the restitution awarded was not analyzed for those considerations.
That's
correct.
It was
just the basic claim from the insured, the victim here.
That's right.
So that component of restitution has not been evaluated as a substantive matter.
Well, Your Honor, it's still coming from the best source possible of information, which would be the victim in this case. And again, falling back on the standard review here a little bit, because none of this was challenged, if this was challenged at a sentencing hearing, the judge could have said, okay, we're moving forward with the custodial sentence, and we're going to set a further date for restitution where we can attack these details at a granular level. Because that did not occur, we're left in the situation we are now, where it's essentially that undisputed portion of the PSR. And sure, that is based on the reported cost of the victim, but if you're going to start an investigation, start an adjudication about the value of items lost in the fire, that has to be your starting point to begin with. And that the insurance company did do some vetting, and that vetting was based on the replacement cost of those items, not the retail value of those items. That all speaks to the propriety of the district court accepting that the value set out by the insurance company based on a replacement cost basis. So even if accepting defendant's argument that we are talking about retail price here, which the government would reject but still move on, that also would not represent clear error. The Lively and Milstein cases from the Sixth and Second Circuits support a calculation based on retail price as a way to fully restore the victim under the MVRA. So if there are no further questions, the government would ask the court to affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hillis, your time had expired, but you can have some additional time if you have something to say in rebuttal. 2 minutes back on the clock.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Where the government mentioned vetting, I take issue. I don't think there was much vetting. It's certainly not apparent in the PSR. There's no report that would be consistent to say there's a complete accounting that we know that there was much vetting. If there's any vetting, it was probably with regard to the $35,000. Once we hit that amount, I don't think the insurance company was poised to investigate anything further, invest itself further in any determinations. As far as the loss amounts asserted by insurance victims are the best source, I would say talk to any claims adjuster on that and you get a different answer. People routinely assert a higher value than what something might be worth, and the insurance company is oftentimes not paying the full amount that's asserted by a victim. As far as whether a person's statements are just a useful data point, whether or not the strategic reason, rather, is just a useful data point, I would say that's hard to reconcile with the preceding case law that says that we should give a liberal interpretation to waiver. If we're just looking at a useful data point, we seem to be doing an illiberal reading of what waiver requires. And so I find that to be problematic.
Well, what about something just a shade less aggressive than that? That it's an especially useful data point when we're considering an ambiguous record or a potentially ambiguous record. As Judge Lee was suggesting, that a strategic reason might be an important component when we're evaluating something less than, you know, I do not want to challenge restitution. When we're looking at something like this record, I don't have any objection to the PSR.
I think if it's ambiguous, it leans towards a liberal construction, not to a liberal construction. But may mention one quick thing on supervised release regarding that compared to restitution. Supervised release, it could be that there were so many cases, people were desperate to turn off the spigot, somebody aggravated the court to no end, I couldn't say. But I will say that with regard to the two things as a conceptual matter, they're very different. Like a sentence that you have forever and you're not likely to change, restitution is characteristically different from supervised release conditions that you can modify under 18 U.S.C. 3583. There's a procedure for that. Once you get a restitution judgment against you, it is worse than anything because you can't even assert ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to restitution amounts. So you are shackled with this non-dischargeable debt for all times. You may be able to get a sentence reduction in some regard, even on your criminal sentence, for the amount of imprisonment you have. But I see no way to ever challenge this loss amount that is very different from what you could do, at least vis-a-vis supervised release, in order to change both the length and the conditions of supervision. So I do think that there is a conceptual difference that should be considered, and not to mention, last but least, my client was proceeding pro se, and he seemed a bit addled to me about what was going on in the proceedings. I have nothing further.
All right, thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And our